Hello, Ramblers and Gamblers. Actually, I had a listener request for more O in hello, and, you know, you ask, I deliver. Josh Rosenthal here. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling, and the old email, ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. We're loaded today. Joe House is back, making a second appearance on the pod. We're talking a little NBA at the end, but mostly golf. The PGA Championship is this weekend, and I want to talk about Phil Mickelson. This is a wild story, and more and more these days, it seems to involve gambling, so we'll delve into that. David Purdom of ESPN is back with us, too. He had a cool column last week about, quote, paranoid bookmakers who fear an unavoidable black swan event. So I asked if he'd come on and chat about it. And lastly, we've got a gentleman named Ricky Cobb joining us. Ricky is the brains behind the absolutely awesome and insanely popular Twitter feed called Super 70s Sports. It's really good. And it's a fun interview. I hope you'll stick around for that one. Anyway, let's get things started with the man, the myth, the legend, Joe House. House, let me tell you, bud, it is my pleasure. It is my honor to have you, the pride of the DMV, back on the Rambling and Gambling pod for a second time. Thanks for coming back, man.
JR, I appreciate very much you giving me the opportunity. Your standards are low, which is good. That's a good fit. That means both of us are coming at it from the same place.
So I appreciate that. Yeah. Hey, my pleasure, man. My pleasure. All right. I asked you on to talk about the PGA Championship, which we're going to do. But I don't think there's any way to have this conversation if we don't start with Phil, who's not even playing. Just in case anybody needs a refresher, buckle up. Here's the timeline. 1 year ago, Phil Mickelson comes out of nowhere to win the PGA. Oldest guy to ever win a major at age 50. Fans storm the course. Everybody's chanting, lefty, lefty. One of the most popular guys in tour history somehow becomes even more popular. And then he makes some really controversial comments about a Saudi-funded golf league. He was talking to Alan Shipnuck, who's writing a biography about Phil. Loses all of his endorsements. He hasn't played since. He's basically gone dark since February. But during that time, another excerpt from Shipnuck's book is released saying Phil had more than $40 million in gambling losses between 2010 and 2014. And if that wasn't enough, an ESPN article published this week says that people close to Mickelson are actually more concerned about another book, Billy Walters' memoir, which is set to come out sometime next year. In case anybody doesn't know, Walters is widely regarded as the best sports bettor ever, but he also went to prison for insider trading, was ultimately granted clemency by President Trump just before he left office. And Walters has also spoken out previously about being pissed off with Phil because he felt Phil was in a position to help him by testifying during Walters' trial, which Phil did not do. House, this is nuts. Take that wherever you want to go.
Well, all of what you just described is a testament to the complicated character that is Phil Mickelson. You hit on it at the outset, which is one of the most beloved PGA Tour pros of the modern era, second only really to Tiger Woods. And they were, for the first part of each of their respective professional careers, the perfect foil for each other. You know, for most of the early part of Phil's career, he was in Tiger's shadow because Tiger arrived on the scene with so much success. But when Tiger ran into his own personal troubles, and we're talking about the infidelity with his wife, Elin, and, you know, the rehabilitation that he had to go through, that had the effect of bolstering Phil in the public's eye. And Phil really, you know, had a persona of being the man of the people. He has always been beloved in New York for that very reason. He seems like a kind of every guy, relatable kind of character. And, you know, he has a real EQ. He has the ability to understand, you know, how to talk to people. And there is a lot of evidence of him being very generous with his time, generous with his money, and very, very likable, very charismatic. And we've had this long run with him. On the other side of things, the gambling issues with him, and you know, small eye issues, because he, up to this point, it seems like he was able to afford a lifestyle that permitted him to gamble on sports and lose big sums of money on sports. Although now it seems like perhaps he was losing such large chunks of money that it was impacting other areas of his life. One of the things that's come out in Shipnuck's book is that a primary reason for Phil's split with his legendary caddy, Jim Bones McKay, was because he owed Bones money. And, you know, Phil, there have been, you know, stories about him being less generous with his peers, and some of his peers, you know, sort of harboring quiet resentment around a persona out to the public that, you know, sort of one way, and then, you know, inside the locker room, perhaps another way. And that really goes to the heart of the trouble that he is in right now. It is a self-created problem. He's put himself in kind of self-exile. And the real challenge, and the reason that his marketing partners all dropped him, is because he did something to himself. He created the impression that all of this has been a lie, that he's been calculated about it, and that he's phony. And he hasn't yet come up with, it doesn't seem, the right set of talking points to start working his way out of it, or he hasn't come up with the courage to do that. It's unclear. The current thinking, because he decided to not show up at the PGA Championship and defend his title, which feels very unprecedented. The only other times it's happened has been due to injury. Rory McIlroy wasn't able to defend his British Open back in 2015 because he hurt his ankle. It seems like he might be inclined to go play in this Saudi-sponsored event, the first one of which is in London. And, you know, there is a lot of disappointment that could have the effect of, you know, basically severing Phil's relationship with the PGA Tour forever.
Let's say Phil comes to you. House, I know this is going to be miserable whenever I do emerge from hiding. When I do it, when I'm ready to get back on the course, how should I do it? What advice would you give him?
So I would start with the idea, you know, he has to be convinced that the right thing for him to do, the right path for his future, is to remain affiliated with the PGA Tour, because that his popularity is so inextricably linked with U.S. golf tournaments, with going around the country, and he needs to be satisfied that he can make like Arnold Palmer money, $30 to $50 million every year, as a wonderful brand ambassador and spokesman for the tour and for the brands that want to be affiliated and associated with him. He can still play competitive golf, even that though he's 51 years old, on the PGA Tour. He could probably do it for another handful of years and compete with the young kids. And then he could also do, you know, PGA Champions kind of activities. So the advice would be, in the first place, realign yourself with the PGA Tour. That's the best path to rehabilitate, you know, all of the bad effects that are associated with the Saudi tournament. There's no upside for you there other than just regular money. But if you want to be tapped back into the thing that made you attractive in the first place, the charismatic, you know, beloved man of the people, you have to reassociate yourself with the tour. And then it's very easy from there to just, you know, I made a mistake, mea culpa. America loves a redemption story. America will always forgive and let somebody move on, but he has to confess to a mistake has been made. It doesn't seem like he's there yet.
Let's talk about some guys who are actually playing this week. Tiger Woods, who we somehow haven't mentioned, deep into the pod. What do you expect from Tiger this week, House?
So all indications so far from the venue is that his physical disposition and demeanor is improved over what we saw at the Masters. And, you know, he was able to, he was in the top 10 at the end of the day on Thursday, the first round of the Masters. He also made the cut at the Masters. Now, he fell apart somewhat afterwards. The golf fell apart because it became apparent that he was like very physically tired by the physical challenge of taking on Augusta. This week, it seems like there is a pep to his step. He's continued to make progress. His endurance has continued to improve. The gait is better. The reports on the ground is that the bicep curls, the biceps look beautiful. The curls for the girls are in full effect. Uh-huh. And he has been very deliberate and serious about participating in this event. You know, he was out at the golf course with the director of golf. The director of golf for Southern Hills, the venue for this PGA Championship, they played 18 holes. That guy caddied for Tiger a month ago, and Tiger got all – nobody has a better strategic brain for major competitive golf than Tiger Woods, and his brain is in the right place. So we're counting on him not only to make the cut this week, but I think it's reasonable to go ahead and play like a top 25 kind of angle with Tiger.
Really?
Like there's just no reason – he's hitting it fine. Like there's video of him hitting it 357 off the second hole on Monday. He's also showing a variety of shots to take into account like the windy conditions, because they're, you know, it's the plains, so there is this notion that the wind could be prominent. So he's out hitting stingers right now. I mean, he's got the arsenal of shots. His short game, his hands seem in absolutely prime condition. I can attest, having watched him at the Masters, walking with him on Thursday and a good chunk of Friday, how good his short game is. Everything around the green, the magic that he's shown in years past, he has all of that touch, and that's going to come into play by all accounts at this Southern Hills, which has been renovated and restored. Part of that includes, you know, green complexes with shave areas down around the green, so you have to have that touch. Tiger's got it. Why fade Tiger Woods, I say, JR?
Okay, you're making me think, man. During the Masters, I bet on him to make the cut, and then I bet against him on Saturday and Sunday, and I was kind of tentatively planning on doing that, but you're making me think maybe he holds up.
Well, go ahead and bet him to make the cut, and then make your determination about what to do Saturday and Sunday based on what you see Thursday and Friday. I mean, if the weather tracks the way that it's currently forecast, which is super hot Thursday, which actually might be really good for Tiger, right? It could be a kind of natural lubricant, as it were, nice and warm on Friday as well. And then the temperature is going to drop on Saturday and Sunday. It's forecasted not even to get to 70 degrees on Saturday. But, you know, I think it's fine to just use your powers of observation and make a judgment as the weekend arrives.
Scottie Scheffler just won the Masters. He's one of two favorites for the PGA. FanDuel, last I checked, had him at 12-1 along with John Rahm. I'm under the impression Scheffler's got a lot going for him on this course, right?
Yes, he has proclaimed that this is his favorite golf course on planet Earth. He won the Big 12 championship here a handful of years ago before the renovation, but he was out maybe 2.5 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago for a practice round. He shot a tidy 64 in his practice round. And that was with like a pretty like ho-hum front nine on the back nine. He went out and lit the place on fire. Like there's no data, no analytics you can bring to bear to fade Scottie Scheffler. He had a very successful tournament just in McKinney, Texas, that wrapped up on Sunday. Quietly just navigated around, collected another top 15 for himself. But he has it all going. He's on an unmatched heater right now. And there has been some parallels drawn between Augusta National and this venue in its renovated form. The architect of Southern Hills is a guy named Perry Maxwell. Perry Maxwell actually responsible for the design, build, and execution of the greens at Augusta National right before the very first Masters was ever competed there. So if you believe in that through line you would say guys that were successful at Augusta National in that style of play could, should also be successful at Southern Hills. All of that says a lot of good things about Scottie Scheffler's chances.
Is Scheffler your pick to win it?
I actually don't want to go pure chalk. The two guys that I like to win this week are actually Jordan Spieth and or Shane Lowry. Those are my two picks. I love where Spieth is in terms of his game. He's made enormous strides off the tee. He's hitting the ball farther than he ever has. His accuracy off the tee has also been greatly improved. It was a real drag on him when he was in the middle of a slump a couple years ago, but this season he's shown enormous improvement on that. He's already got a win this season, and if we're talking about magic hands and channeling some of the Augusta National magic, Jordan Spieth is the guy that I want to invest in. I also mentioned Shane Lowry, and that's because the quality of his game and all of the categories, off the tee, super strong, accuracy in the green, stroke gained approach, super high, and also a guy, winner of the Open Championship in 2019, which means he's got very deft hands, can get up and down and make par or birdie from all kinds of conditions that might be otherwise adverse to normal humans. So those are my two favorites.
Asking you this mostly because I have to fill out this like pool that I'm doing tonight. Do you have any long shots you think might do better than expected this week?
I don't know if this guy counts as a long shot because he just won here in the DMV, but Max Homa is getting a ton of buzz
because
of his consistency, and he showed us here in Washington. We know as natives here of the DMV just how bad that weather was.
Yeah.
The tour did not suspend play for 1 second. They had those guys out there slogging around the TPC Avenel in pouring rain, and the rough was up, and it was a very difficult challenge. And Homa was up to it mentally, which is, you know, something that you really want, a trait that you want in a major competitor. And he's been, you know, it seems like the only thing missing from his resume is a very high finish in a major. He talked about his own psychological approach, how free he feels. That's what another thing that you want coming in, where he's not feeling the pressure of the moment. Everything is gravy. Positive vibes only, Max Homa.
Any other players and or bets you want to hit before we move on to just a little bit of NBA?
I'm going to do some head-to-heads. I am going to fade Victor Hovland. I'm somewhat sorry to say he's a favorite of mine, but his around the green numbers, he's either last or near last in strokes gained around the green, like in the 200s across all guys. He's got an Oklahoma connection because he went to Oklahoma State, but I don't like him at this venue. So look for opportunities to fade Hovland. If you want to put a tiny bit on miss the cut for him, even I wouldn't hate it, but I'm looking for him in head to heads. And then I'm going to jump on the heater of Xander, who shot 20 something under over the last 54 holes just recently in Texas. This Xander Schauffele, big game hunter, tends to has a bunch of very high performances. His resume is replete with good performances in majors. So just a nice top 20 play for Xander.
Have a few random ones, NBA ones. But before I let you go, Hash, you got time for this? Is that cool?
Of course. Let's do it.
All right. This is the only non-DMV question I have for you. Down to the final four in the NBA. Who do you like and why?
I'm sorry to say that I have to align myself with my lifetime buddy, Bill Simmons, and I'm on the Boston Celtics bandwagon. They are the most complete team on both sides of the basketball. They have demonstrated a kind of resilience in terms of playing different styles. And, you know, the way that they beat the Nets, that 4-0 sweep, I feel like they didn't know that they were that good until they went out and beat the Nets' ass, and they took on Kevin Durant, and they stared him right in the eye, and they took him down. And you know, especially we should all be so lucky to find the fountain of youth that Al Horford has found, because he's literally been, to me, their MVP. Now, Jason Tatum's been spectacular. He's put himself in the conversation as a top five player in the game, all deserved. But secretly, to me, the guy that is stabilizing the entire Celtics enterprise, and in just those guys are all rallying around the power of Al Horford. He is my Celtics MVP. But I think defensively, what they're going to throw at Miami is a Miami hasn't seen this, right? Miami, just through bad luck, had kind of an easy run through the first two rounds. You know, they've had the Hawks and they had the Sixers, neither one of which are considered stalwart defensive teams. The level of defense, the style of defense that Boston's going to bring to the table is going to be a challenge that Miami hasn't seen. And Miami's vulnerability is second line scoring. You know that Butler's going to get his. Tyler Hero at home will get his. Beyond that, where's the scoring going to come from? And you can't point to Bam Adebayo because Boston has a very unique solution to that. They have a three-headed monster in the form of Daniel Tice, but more importantly, Horford and Time Lord Williams, that is just very unique to Boston. So I think they're going to produce some challenges for Miami.
I'm betting on Boston to win it too. Also, okay. Regrettably, I think they beat Dallas. By the way, in the finals,
that's interesting.
It's a little different.
I like it. Okay.
It probably just means it's going to be Miami Golden State in the final.
Probably.
But that is what I'm betting. Let's see. Oh, how are you feeling about the Wiz and our big midseason trade after watching Spencer Dinwiddie drop 30 in Game 7 against Phoenix?
I feel the exact same way as I felt at the time of the trade. They had to move on. I don't regret anything with respect to the Wizards reaching the conclusion that Bertans and Dinwiddie were expendable at that moment. You know, the Wizards tried an experiment. They brought in Dinwiddie to sort of be a kind of co-alpha with Bradley Beal, and for whatever reason it didn't happen. The chemistry there didn't work out, and the team, like the locker room, it seems, didn't really subscribe to what Dinwiddie was selling, and so it just wasn't going to work. And I admire the team saying, look, we tried this, it was an experiment, it failed, we can get better by not having Davis Bertans' contract any longer. And why try and force Dinwiddie to be a success here? It doesn't seem like it's going to work. And they got back. I mean, you know, who knows what Porzingis will be, and who knows what version of the Wizards when October rolls around, you know, what this team is going to look like personnel wise. But I don't think there was anything wrong with the trade. And Dinwiddie, you know, to his credit, has taken advantage of a really terrific situation where he's playing with one of the three best players on the planet.
Speaking of Porzingis, my favorite fake trade I've seen bandied about Twitter recently, which is probably completely improbable. What do you think of this though? Porzingis for Ayton, little sign-in trade, DeAndre, something's going on in Phoenix, looking for a change. Maybe they're looking for a 7-footer with range. What do you think, House?
So I don't hate it. The only thing that gives me pause is Ayton wasn't able to be successful in Phoenix. And the reason he wasn't able to be successful, it seems, is a maturity problem. So is Washington developmentally the team that will work with him and help him develop? Now, part of that could be the lack of Ayton's success could be attributable to a bad attitude that emanates from him not getting the max extension that he feels like he deserved. And he just couldn't get over it. And that can happen. He's a young kid. So if you're being glass half full with Ayton, I think it's the case that he will never play another minute for the Phoenix Suns. I believe that relationship is fractured beyond repair. And so I bet Phoenix would be in a position looking to get back something of value for Ayton. Porzingis is not, you know, I think he's kind of conducive to the style of play they have in Phoenix. Phoenix has bigger challenges in front of it, namely what to do with Chris Paul and the point guard position. But if you know for sure that Ayton's not going to play another minute for your team, Porzingis isn't a bad haul for them. And I think Ayton, again, if you get him the extension that he thinks he's entitled to, and he's happy, and you have a game plan here in Washington for his development. He's shown a lot. He should be a 20 and 10 guy every single night. And I like that trade of going so much younger and a guy that doesn't have the same injury history as Porzingis. I don't hate it.
By the way, for the listeners, we are taping this Tuesday. It's going to go live Wednesday morning. So if something amazing happens at the draft lottery, which is happening tonight, I believe the Wiz have like something like a 3-4% chance of landing the number one overall pick. That's why House and I didn't talk about it today. One more House. This is what we're going home with, man. Supposedly, Commanders rookie quarterback Sam Howell only eats chicken. And not only that, this guy says he has never eaten steak. When I heard this, I swear to you, you were the first person I thought of. Go ahead, House. What do you think of this?
I can't trust him. I mean, I need to know the circumstances in his life when he was a young kid that his parents never put steak in front of him and said, you just have to try a bite. You just have to eat this much. Nobody's saying eat the whole steak. Nobody put a 10-ounce filet in front of him when he was young and said, eat the whole thing. I will confess that I haven't done the deep dive into the backstory as to how or why it is that he's never confronted a steak, but that also means that he hasn't had a delicious cheeseburger, that he won't eat a cheeseburger. How can you trust a guy like this? Now, look, if he had health and ethical concerns in his life as a kid and was raised a certain way with vegetarianism or veganism, and that was a family tradition, then that would be fine. Like, I can roll with all that.
He eats chicken. He eats chicken.
Yeah, but that's the point. He's neither of those things. And it doesn't seem to have anything to do with an ethical concern. It has to do with his entirely dull taste buds. And my question to you is, how can you trust a person who lacks that kind of imagination, that lacks that kind of ambition? How can you trust chicken only Sam? I just don't know. It just means the hurdle is that much higher for him to prove it to us here in the DMV, JR.
The answer to that last question, House, is you can't trust him.
I think that's true, but like, I'm an open-minded fellow. If he comes out and he's throwing the rock all over the joint, I'll at least consider it. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. I know you're doing like a million pods right now. You're so in demand, especially because the PGA coming up. Plug away, man. What do you got? What's going on?
So, JR, we have the latest iteration of Fairway Rollin' is posted right now. We interviewed Kevin Van Valkenburg, who is physically in Tulsa, Oklahoma, of ESPN. He co-authored a story about Phil and Phil's troubles. So that's up on ESPN.com. But KVV was one guest, and then we had Jeff Newbarth, who is a producer working on the ESPN broadcast. So that show is up right now. That's Fairway Rolling in terms of just trying to set the scene. There will be another Fairway Rolling out on Wednesday. It'll go up overnight Tuesday and into Wednesday. That's where we sit down with our analytics guru, Justin Ray, the nation's preeminent analytics, golf analytics guru, and go through the whole card and get his leans and preferences. So that's Fairway Rolling. The Ringer Gambling Show is going up Tuesdays and typically Fridays, although this week we're going to go up on Thursday. We've got some early leans from me and John Jastrzemski, JJ, on series prices in this Eastern Conference Final and the Western Conference Final, as well as our leans on the games this week. And we'll have another show up on Thursday midday where we'll go through the card through the weekend and, you know, maybe some repricing and also probably some observations on how to live bet the PGA Championship, because, you know, the gambling never ends, JR.
Never ends. I'll be listening to all of it as I always do. Joe House, Ringer, Spotify, pride of the DMV. Killed it again, man. Thanks so much.
JR, anytime you throw up the bat signal, I'm here for you, buddy.
Be careful, House. You know I will. Take it easy, man.
You too.
All right, it is time to check back in with, if you ask me, the single best reporter on the gambling beat, friend of the pod, ESPN's David Purnham. Dave, how you been, man?
I'm great. You're overselling me a little bit, but I'm doing all right.
I mean it. You know I mean it. Speaking of, loved your column this week. It's about how sports books are in near constant fear of what you call black swan events. You pretty much tell the story with two examples, both from January 9th of this year. Dave, I'll just sum up one of them quickly to give listeners an idea of what we're talking about, and then we'll get into it. This was the night that Klay Thompson made his long-awaited return from injury. The game against the Cavs was supposed to tip off, as you write, at 8:40, and at 8:31, 9 minutes before, the Warriors tweet that Draymond Green would be on the floor for the tip as a way of honoring Klay, but that'd be it. He'd leave the game right after that because he was nursing a calf injury. So immediately, bettors everywhere rush to not only bet Draymond Green unders, points, rebounds, assists, they parlayed the unders, and they adjusted them. So instead of getting, and I'm making this up, minus 110 odds on Draymond under 10 points, they got plus 500 odds on Draymond under 2 points. And then they parlayed it with other adjusted lines, creating bets that literally could not lose. And they got them at like 20-1 odds. Most books caught it quickly. DraftKings did not. And they ended up paying out seven figures. Dave, how'd I do?
That's pretty much it. I mean, it was an 8-minute flurry and sportsbooks lost millions of dollars. What happened to DraftKings is that when they tried to take off all the Draymond Green props, like most books did, they were able to do it on the straight bets, right? You couldn't just go in there and bet Draymond under 2 points or whatever it was. They did not take them off the same game parlays. It did not trigger that. And those were still there and people found out and they went just nuts. And you described it that, you know, they didn't just bet it at the normal prices. They adjusted it to where they got super odds. You know, you may be a 3-team parlay at typical odds. Maybe you get 5, maybe you get 6-1, may at the most, they're getting close to 20-1. So they shredded them pretty good.
And then what I loved you wrote about, and I hope I'm not confusing the examples here, but like one guy, like basically bettors who really won off this were mostly limited the following day. DraftKings was like, okay, thanks. Now you're kind of done. And somebody complained about it. And they're like, well, the 130K that you won off of this is not a bad consolation prize. Is that right? That is, right?
Yeah, that's what happened. I mean, you know, people will argue about the fairness of taking some sort of retribution towards the bettors that got this information and used it to win. Fair or not, it's realistic. It's what's going to happen. You know, that's thing. And some people went to the chat and asked, hey, why did this happen? Why did this happen? And they got the, you know, kind of the typical standard responses that we've assessed your account and adjusted the skill and so forth. And now we've made your limits what we believe to be appropriate. And that one guy would complain and said, you know, at least you got the $120,000. And really that becomes the debate for these guys at this point. When you find something that is a sure thing in a way and you take advantage of it, you have to weigh, well, if I do this, they may cut my limits, they may shut down my account, is it worth it? A lot of these guys, six figures, probably. So
I had never heard the term glitch hunters before. You wrote about it, but apparently there are people who this is what they do. They look for mistakes that they can capitalize on.
Mm-hmm. It is. There's big communities of it, and they actually hire a lot of college kids, and the college kids will constantly just scour through the sports books looking for mistakes, looking for typos. Is a team supposed to be favored by 10, but is actually favored by 1? They left off the 0 or something like that, and they will look for those things. They also look up to ways to exploit the little bonus signups, you know, when you put in money and they give you. So they'll look for all kinds of different ways to do those. There's a very famous one from right when we started legalization, 2018, FanDuel tried to make the Broncos a 6-1 underdog late in the game against the Raiders, I believe. And they had a chance to on a drive to win the game. But when they put in 6, they actually ended up with 75-1, which is a ridiculous number for any NFL and people capitalize on that. And that was the first big story about these things that people call palpable errors by the sports book. And, you know, isn't that what you're trying to do? You're trying to see whether you think the book has made a mistake with the odds. So you try to take advantage and you look at those. Now you have to also, again, weigh the risk. Am I going to take advantage of this obvious error and suffer the consequences? Kind of depends on where you stand on the with your sports book.
So this is one example that you open your piece with, but essentially a big picture, the fear among books, correct me if I'm wrong, is that a ton of people would somehow all bet the same crazy thing and basically wipe them out, right?
Yeah. You know, we have all these communities now that bettors are congregating in, like Discords and so forth online, and they will send out parlay picks and everybody jumps on board of them. And if there's ever one that's going to hit and there's thousands of bettors on it, it's going to be very costly. I guess a good example would be Pat McAfee, the former NFL punter who's, you know, a charismatic personality now. He works for FanDuel and he often recommends single same game parlays. And FanDuel say they'll get 100,000 bets on that same game parlay. And so, you know, if that parlay happens to pay 50-1 or 100-1, it can get very expensive. And where it gets really difficult for the sports books is they're hard to track the liability on it. And we'll probably talk about this tie scenario here in a little bit, but people get creative in the way they try to bet these things. And so the sports books, they don't have a very firm grasp. They sort of know how much they would lose if something like that happens. But it can grow, you know, exponentially quickly and put them in a spot of danger.
Let's do the tie scenario. So this was the same night as the Clay thing. This was January 9th, and this was a close call for the books, a very close call. That was also week 18 for the NFL season. And basically because Jacksonville, which was like a huge underdog, had won earlier in the day, there was a situation where it actually made sense for the Chargers and the Raiders to tie, and both of them would have gotten into the playoffs had they done so. And take it from there. A lot of people, Dave, had the two things combined already, right? Jacksonville and the tie.
They started talking about the scenario that would have to result would be Jacksonville losing to the Colts, which is a 14-point underdog. The Steelers needed to beat the Ravens on the road. They were a small dog. If those two things happened, the Raiders and Chargers would both advance to the playoffs with a tie. And people started talking about that early in the week, and bettors loved it. It was just kind of something cool, fun to bet, and it was a small bet, and you got pretty big odds on it because a 14-point underdog winning outright, you get 6-7-1, and an NFL game ending in a tie, you get like 150-1. Well, parlaying those together, you're looking at, you know, almost 1,000-1 odds. And people did that over and over and over. And at the beginning of the week, their books were like, whatever, you know, ha ha ha, we'll just take that, no big deal. But time the game rolled around, and then everything played out to make that exact situation extremely viable. It was remarkable. The Raiders had a chance in overtime where they could attempt a long field goal. If that long field goal is blocked and the Chargers were to return it for a touchdown, they'd be out of the playoffs. Otherwise, they kneel down. Both teams would go to the playoffs. Ultimately, they decide to kick the field goal. If they were a win, that would send them to Cincinnati. If a loss would have sent them to, or a tie would have sent them to Kansas City. So they made the choice. But at that time, the books were on the hook for what they say was the largest payout in their history for FanDuel.
And I mean, it was that close. It was that close. The Raiders probably should have just taken a knee.
Yeah, could have very easily. I think there was a late timeout by the Chargers that if they didn't take that, a lot of people think they would just kneeled out and would have tied.
Is there anything sports books can do to mitigate this type of risk?
That is another issue. I'm not sure you can. What are you going to do? A 14-point underdog, like I said, 6-7-1 typically. You're going to put them at 3-1 or something, 2-1. I don't know how you do that. And then also, are you going to make the tie? You know, a tie is typically 150-1, the odds are. There's less than 2% of games, excuse me, less than 1% of games. It's 0.02% of regular season NFL games have ended in a tie. So 150-1 doesn't even equal that. You know, it is just a very, very long odds. And when the people started correlating them together, I don't know how they could have done the risk. They moved the number down. It got down to a ridiculous 11-1 at Borgata. I mean, that's crazy. Which is nothing, right?
Right.
And people are still betting it. I guess another one of the weirdest stats from that day, the most popular two-team parlay out of everything on the board was a tie in Raiders Chargers and Colts Jaguar, Jaguars win over the Colts. Most popular thing. And the odds the books were offering were not anywhere close to where they should have been. It should have been 1,000 to 1. People were betting it 100 to 1.
It's crazy. It's so crazy. I should also say here, there is reason, obviously, that books offer these crazy bets with with these crazy odds, and that's because they win them the vast majority of the time. I don't want anyone to think that we're just sitting here feeling sorry for the books, because there's a reason that they put those out there. Dave, I imagine that smaller books would be the most susceptible to this kind of potential, in their eyes, disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. The bigger books, they probably would be able to withstand. Everybody would have withstood what happened on Sunday, but even if they would have tied. But if it gets to a point where the market grows and we get continued larger and larger and larger liabilities on these same game parlays, and maybe somebody's not paying attention and there's an error in the algorithm or something happens and bettors take advantage of it, it's going to be very, very, very costly, because regulators have done a very good job of, when books make a mistake, they hold them accountable for it. Books that are overseas, a lot of the times they'll get off the hook. Oh, that was a typo. We'll pay you at what the odds should have been, or whatever. That hasn't been the case here in the U.S. So if a smaller operator was to take a huge hit like that, there would be some concern.
You ever see a scenario where a book actually gets wiped off the map because of this? There's one loss that hits them so hard they're out of it.
I mean, it seems far-fetched, but yeah, there's a scenario out there that can happen. I mean, there was in the early 80s, late 70s, there was a Las Vegas sports book who offered ridiculous odds on, I want to say it was World Series or something like that, and they didn't believe it's going to happen, and he got crushed. And the next day, people went over to the sports book. This is when they were just independent little, almost convenience store type things, not connected to casinos. And there was a sign on the door, closed. For a long time, people eventually got all their money back, but it's happened before back in the day. Will it happen again? Very, very long shot, but it's possible.
After publishing this one, I know you're incredibly connected. What did you hear from books, their reaction? And then also, what did you hear just from normal square bettors like yours truly?
Well, I think some of the bettors in general, more of the savvy bettors, were kind of like what you said. Oh, we're not here feeling sorry for the books and this, that's not going to happen. And that wasn't really what I was trying to do for the point of the piece. I was just trying to do a scenario there. Sportsbooks acknowledged it. He's like, those things, same game parlays, our margin on them is very, very comfy, huge, huge margins, 20% plus, easily. But yet, they are dangerous because you just don't know. And let's real quick, an example on that tie thing. This is how creative guys got. They've made parlays, same game parlays, and they would put the Raiders +3. Or I think it was a Raiders -3, Chargers +3. Both of those would hit right if the game was a tie.
Yeah.
They put the final score ending in the even number. Both of those went in a tie. They parlayed all these together. One bettor in New Jersey told me he had about a couple $1,000, and he was in position to win $800,000 if they would have tied.
Oh my God. Can you imagine sitting there and that being that guy watching that game?
I don't even know what the books knew, because of those creative things that they had in there. Can they push a button? It doesn't seem like that to me.
I mean, I remember watching that game. I was visiting my in-laws in Minnesota at the time, and I remember being like, "Oh, this should be a tie. They should just, if I had a ticket to win $800,000, I'd be pulling my hair out."
Crazy, wild night. That whole same time, the whole thing, Draymond Green's going on.
I know.
All the stories.
It's wild. You do such a great job unearthing some of this stuff, and just makes us gambling folk think about things that maybe we hadn't thought about previously. So nice job as always with this one, man. What else? You have anything interesting coming down the pike? You want to plug anything?
We're going to do some NFL content here in the early June. What the funniest thing going on right now, in my opinion, is the action on the Jets. The Jets have attracted the second most money and bets to win the Super Bowl up at the Borgata in New York. Now, there's some local bias up there, but all around the nation, the most popular bet on the season win totals, the over-under, Jets over. So I think that's pretty funny that people are piling on the Jets for their ineptitude and for such a long time.
I mean, it looked to me like they had a nice draft, nice little offseason here, but it's still the Jets. That's crazy, right?
To win the Super Bowl, to win the AFC, come on. You know, that's not happening. You can bet the over on the wins. I think it's 5.5, sure. But the Super Bowl, that seems like a charitable donation to the sports books.
David Pert of ESPN, RNG fave for sure. Great having you come back on, man. Thanks again.
Thank you, Josh.
Wrapping things up today with an interview I'm really excited about. Ricky Cobb, who started the Super 70s Sports Twitter feed, which now has nearly 600,000 followers. How you doing, Ricky? Thanks for joining me.
Hey, man. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm great. And it's a pleasure to be here with the face of DC News.
Oh, hell, that is far too kind, my friend. To start out, I want to explain Super 70 Sports to anybody who hasn't seen it. Basically, you post awesome vintage pictures and videos, sometimes with hilarious, oftentimes raunchy captions. So, for example, just in the past few days, you posted an old Bob Uecker commercial, which was great. For some reason, I love Bob Uecker. If people haven't seen Norm MacDonald talk about hanging out with Uecker, you should YouTube. It's really good. You also posted a terribly set up photo of an old NBA All-Star team that included Larry Bird, Isaiah Thomas. It was really good. And then there's one that had me cracking up of George Brett and Mike Schmidt, like sitting in director's chairs on a baseball field with like fruity drinks that had like umbrellas in them in hand. I spent like an hour on there the other night, Ricky. It's a really good Twitter feed.
Well, thank you, man. That pleases me to hear you say that. Yeah, I you know, started screwing around a few years ago, and you know, here I am, like 7-8 years later, and I've created this community, and you know, it's been a pretty amazing thing.
Why did you start it?
You know, that is a question that I've been asked many times, and that I've reflected on, and you know, it's really one of those things where I look back on it and I just feel very fortunate that I got a wild hair to start a Twitter feed. You know, it was, I think, Christmas break, maybe about 7 or 8 years ago from my day job. I'm a college professor by day, probably not for a lot longer. But, you know, it was one of those things where I think I was just looking for an outlet. You know, I've always been the guy that's comedically minded, and I certainly have an affection for the era that I grew up in and the sports of that time. So I thought maybe it was a natural fit to kind of merge the two and see if I couldn't have some funny comedic takes on the era that I know so well from my childhood. And surprisingly, much to my surprise, I've made a lot of friends doing something that I really would have been surprised if you had talked to me several years ago. I would have thought if I'd gotten 500 followers, that would have been pretty crazy. So to be where I am now is you know, I every day I get up and I feel so lucky.
Well, it's crazy because I read an article about you that was published in the Chicago Tribune in 2019, and it talked about how you're a sociology professor, and also that you had turned this Twitter feed, which at the time I think was like 200,000-300,000 followers. Now, as I said earlier, you're almost at 6. You turned it into, correct me if I'm wrong, but a legitimate business, and you've got a website and an apparel company. Is that right? This is really thriving.
Yeah. Super70sportsstore.com. I'm nothing if not excited to give a plug anytime I can. But yeah, you know, you get an audience that is so large and enthusiastic, and it becomes time consuming, frankly. I put a lot of time into this, and I don't know what it says about me, but I probably never worked harder at anything in my life than this brand, this Super 70 Sports. And so to be able to make some people happy and put some t-shirts on people's backs that are, you know, I think evocative of the 70s and 80s and 90s and the kinds of shirts that, quite frankly, you don't, you know, you tend not to find other places. So it's been a lot of fun, and the feedback on that has been great as well.
Where do you find the stuff that you post? Like that picture of George Brett and Mike Schmidt, it was so random. And like this morning I was looking there and you posted like an old picture with a very funny caption of Pete Rose. Where are you digging this stuff out of?
you just got to roll up your sleeves and do some weird searches. I've told people before that I have probably, you know, I have one of the most awkward non-pornographic browser histories of anyone in this country. You know, if people look through it, it would be an interesting case study into the mind of one man who's trying to entertain folks on Twitter. But yeah, you've just got to go out there and dig for it. And people now, thankfully, will send me stuff, and that makes it a little bit easier. I always tell people, you know, by all means, people will ask, can I send you something? And I'll say, please send me baskets of things, because it makes my job a lot easier when the material falls in my lap. But there's really no secret to it other than hard work. It's out there. I think sometimes people think that I have access to some portal of nostalgia that the rest of us don't, but it's out there. You just got to be willing to sacrifice irresponsible, amounts of time into looking for it. And I guess I was the guy who decided to go swimming in there and try that.
It's paid off with some pretty famous fans. If I'm not mistaken, you are followed by Dale Earnhardt Jr., John Elway, Jimmy Kimmel. I think Reggie Jackson once liked one of your tweets. That was from the Tribune article. Have you ever interacted with any of these famous followers of yours?
Yeah, you know, that's pretty wild. Early on, I think that's when I knew that something strange was happening with the account, when I started to see retweets and likes and started to get some follows from people that I actually knew who they were. You know, that was pretty heady stuff. And so, yeah, I've made a lot of acquaintances and a lot of friends through doing this. And many of whom are folks that I've enjoyed their work for many years. The athletes that you're a fan of when you're 10 or 12 or 13 years old, you know, those folks are always going to be a big deal to you, even when you're a grown man. The athletes of today, I can sort of get excited about them to a degree, but whoever was a big deal to you when you were a kid, you know, those people are always going to be a big deal to you. So when you see a retweet or a comment from somebody that you're genuinely a fan of, it's a pretty gratifying thing. You know, there've been a few times I've pinched myself, for sure.
Who'd you pinch yourself on? Give me one of those.
Oh God. Well, one of the recent ones, I guess, you know, even though I'm talking about the old school people meaning more to me, you know, Tom Brady retweeted me a few months ago. I made a tweet about the Tom Brady TB12 method, and I had posted a photo of a shirtless Terry Bradshaw, who's, you know, kind of got the guns out and kind of sucking his gut in. And I said, you know, that was the TB 12 beers a day method.
Nice. And Brady, what, retweeted you?
Brady retweeted it and said, tomato, tomato. you know, so things like that. You always know one is a big one when I'll hear about it from people sending me messages. I think that I realized that Brady had retweeted me when I got two or three messages from my buddies saying, dude, Tom Brady. And I'm thinking, dude, Tom Brady, what? You know, what happened? They're like, well, he retweeted you. You know, so you got to have a little bit of kid in you, probably in my case, a lot of kid in you, to get up and fart around on Twitter all day, every day, as an educated grown man. So, you know, I still get a kick out of some of those things that happen. And, you know, if I didn't get a kick out of stuff like that, I'm probably in the wrong line of work.
You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, Ricky. Currently, do you make more money off of the Twitter feed and everything associated with that, or with your job as a professor?
I make more money from Super 70 Sports now.
Get out of here.
My job as a professor, yeah. And I am thinking very, very seriously of moving out of education later this year and just focusing on the brand full time, because you know, there are some other things that are percolating in the background right now, and some other opportunities that are out there. And I think it's one of those deals where, you know, teaching is a pretty good gig. You know, when you have a tenured professor position, it's not something that you give up lightly or that you walk away from lightly. But I think Super 70s has grown to a point now where I'm really invested in seeing, you know, how much the brand can be grown and what other opportunities are out there for Super 70s to take this brand and move it, you know, outside the confines of Twitter and you know, reach a larger audience even than we have now.
What a world, man. What a world. That's fantastic. All right, Ricky, bring us home here. Just give me one of your favorite all-time tweets. Describe the picture. Give me the caption.
Well, the one that I suppose put me on the map, if there was any one that did that, was the tweet of Howard Cosell from the, I believe it was the 1977 Battle of the Network Stars. And he's flanked on his left by O.J. Simpson, flanked to his right by Bruce Jenner. And I believe the caption was something to the effect of, ladies and gentlemen, I've looked into the future and you're not going to believe this shit. and so that one took off. And, you know, sometimes it's funny, you know, how a certain thing will sort of hit the sweet spot and get memed and go around widely and get shared so much. And so that one ended up with, I think, around 50,000 retweets and somewhere over 100,000 likes. And I think that tweet, probably as much as any one tweet, probably, you know, elevated the name of the Twitter account a little bit and started to give it some attention. So, you know, that's the one that I'm always trying to beat. When I get up every day, you've got to have some benchmark. And so that's the one. It's going to be hard to top that one, but, you know, I get up every day and I try anyway.
This is so good. Ricky, plug away, man. Where can listeners find you?
You can find me obviously on Twitter at Super 70 Sports. The store is super70sportsstore.com. We've also got a link in the bio on Twitter for that. And I always tell people I can't promise that you're going to buy a shirt, but I definitely will tempt the hell out of you if you go to the store and you look around. It's going to be decision time.
I haven't bought one yet, but I have come close.
I'm working on you. We're softening you up now.
There you go, Ricky.
You're going to crack like an egg at some point in the future.
Oh, I'm sure I will. I'm a sucker for this type of thing. Ricky Cobb, check him out over at the Super 70s Sports Twitter feed. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, my man. I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
There it is, ladies and gents. Hope you enjoyed that one as much as I did. Thanks to House, Dave, and Ricky. We'll be back next week. As always, thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling, and the email ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Everybody, have a great week.